Well, since we're past the witching hour, even if it is 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning, I think we probably ought to start. And seeing as we're also missing the moderator, I'm going to usurp authority and attempt to do something I wasn't planning on doing. This panel, obviously, is reality made fantastic, and you can either say that we're the second string, because it's the second time it's done, but I prefer to think that we are the later and greater version of the same topic. And I'm going to follow time-tested procedure and allow each of the panelists to say something about who they are and why they think they're here, starting with Sally.
Good morning. I'm Sally Harding. I'm a literary agent with the Cook Agency here in Toronto. I represent both children's books and science fiction fantasy that deal with, you know, that shady line, shall we say, between reality and fantasy. And we're based in Toronto, but in terms of genre, most of our sales are into the US and internationally.
Since Isabel's getting seated, why don't we go down to Carl?
Hi, I'm Carl Schrader. I'm accused of being a hard science fiction writer, but don't let that stop you. I write works that, in terms of reader response, are deliberately intended to blur the line between the fantastic and science fiction. Ventus, my first novel, is about 200, 300 pages in before you realize that you're not reading high fantasy novel, but actually science fiction. My latest series, the Virga books, five books, full of sword fights and pirates and boarding parties and just plain fun. But again, it's categorized as hard science fiction, so a lot of fantasy readers won't discover it. We can talk more about that. Anyway.
Morning, everybody. My name is Gregory Wilson. I'm an associate professor of English at St. John's University in Queens, New York, where I teach courses in creative writing, science fiction, and fantasy, among others. I'm looking forward to going back to work tomorrow. As you know, we've been a little busy over the past week down there. I'm also a writer. My first novel came out a few years back called The Third Sign. Next two are being shopped. And I have a couple of articles from the SIFO Bulletin and a short story just out in an anthology called When the Villain Comes Home. I'm also co-editing an anthology in speculative fiction and politics with authors such as Mr. Lee Modisett to my left in that anthology. And I run a podcast with Brad Bollier called Speculate, the podcast for writers, readers, and fans, which has been running for over a year, probably close to closing in on 2 years now, actually. In which we interview authors, editors, artists, and people like that in the speculative field, and then talk about writing and reading techniques related to those things. And you can find out about that at speculatesf.com.
Hi, my name's Isabel Carmody. I'm Australian. And aside from fulfilling the author's required personality of being absent-minded and out there talking instead of on the panel. I've written 30 books, so I'm absent-minded sometimes for a reason. Most of it's published as science fiction or fantasy or science fantasy. I think I'd like to be called slipstream, which I understand is another genre, speculative genre.
That makes you one of the cool kids.
Yeah.
And I started writing when I was 14. I didn't write for adolescence. I was one when I started to write. I'm just finishing that series now that I started at 14, which was the first book that I had published, and I'm somewhat older than the teenager, but the story is still very rich for me. I don't see myself as so much a fantasy writer as just simply a writer who happens to use tools that work for me, which lead me to the science fiction and fantasy category.
I'm Lee Modisett, and I started out writing science fiction many, many years ago, and a lot of people claim that I never stopped writing science fiction, even though I've got four fantasy series, which is probably why I'm on this panel. It also brings up the question of, I guess to put it very simply, where do you draw the line between the fantastic and the real? I suspect every author has a different point of view as to where that is. And I think we'll start at the other end with Carl. because he's already sort of touched on that particular point. And we'll end up with Sally because, as an agent, she's got to look at it from the most critical point of view.
Yes, marketing categories. You know what? I have no idea where to draw that line. I think it's a mug's game to try. The reason that I do what I do is I love the idea of finding the fantastic in the mundane, and of the translation of real life into magic. For the Virga books, which is the series that just wrapped up, I limited myself to Newtonian physics and came up with absolutely magical stuff. It's a zero gravity world, a balloon 5,000 miles in diameter with a little bit of air and floating chunks of rock and water in it. Gravity is a municipal utility because towns are wooden and rope things that are spun for gravity. The hero rides around on a wingless jet engine with a handlebar and saddle. And as I say, there's pirates and sword fights and everything traditional. The whole purpose of that construct is to create wonder, but possible wonder, because this place could exist. And for me, that's a particular game that I like to play. Can I make a world where cities go to battle and throw neighborhoods at one another? Things like that. And do it within the constraints of the real world. So for me, I'm not burdened by too great a grasp of reality in my ordinary life. And so I just write, within, like I say, the parameters of this particular game, rather than trying to define what's real and what's not.
Great.
I'm still grappling with the idea of gravity as a municipal utility. We can't even get power in the city. One of the things I thought about in relation to this, I think when I first started myself both writing and studying in the field, I had a much more rigid sense of the line between the worlds of the real and the fantastic. And this, I guess, is what we all start with, where fantasy becomes purely escapism. And you're getting away from what it is that you know, although in fact, as I heard on a panel yesterday, all you're really doing is reading stuff and entering worlds that are variations on the existent world we know. There is no utterly different fantastic world, or we wouldn't have any frame of reference, right? So it depends on how many variations are involved in the world that you're thinking about. But as you get older and you get more involved in the field, you start discovering that these lines blur quite a bit. And two books that I thought about in relation to this in opposite ways are, first of all, China Medieval City and the City, in which you have here a world in which, for a good portion of that book at the early beginning, doesn't feel fantastic at all. It feels very much like a straight police procedural. And if you weren't aware that it was China Medieval who had written it, and if you weren't getting it from your fantasy and science fiction shelves in the bookstore, you might think you had stumbled into a regular police procedural. And it's only later on that you begin to realize that there is in fact a fantastic element that is literally underpinning the entire book. But there, I think, the reality gives a sort of rigidity to the fantasy, so that even when you find out what the fantastic twist is, that's still is very much driven by the realistic world that Miéville has established at that point. On the other side, you have a book like Neil Gaiman's The Graveyard Book, in which you have a graveyard and a town side by side, but here the fantasy in some ways overwhelms the real, and literally there's a chapter called Danse Macabre in which the ghosts from the graveyard sweep down into the town and dance with the townspeople, so that literally there is no line, right? It's completely elided at that moment between the worlds of the real and the fantastic. And Gaiman himself has gone both directions on this. In American Gods, the gods are driven by the reality. Here, really, the reality is driven by the fantastic. So I've become more interested, I think, in the ways that the lines are blurred and how that will sometimes go back and forth, even within the course of one book.
For me, the thing that I'm interested in as a writer is that line itself, the moment when it blurs, like when you wake up from a dream and you for a moment can't can't tell whether what just happened to you is a dream or was something real. I love that line of Chuang Tzu's, which says Chuang Tzu dreamed he was a butterfly, and he when he woke up, he couldn't tell if he had been Chuang Tzu dreaming he was a butterfly or a butterfly dreaming he was Chuang Tzu. And for me, that quote perfectly categorizes the thing that fascinates me as a writer. I did start when I was a kid writing, as lots of people do. It's nothing unusual about that. But fantasy, it was always, for a period, considered to be the literature of children, not as it was often in adult worlds, trash reading and junk reading and pleasure reading and escapism. For children, you could be a literary writer who is also a writer of fantasy. It's acceptable. And so I come from that kind of background. And I saw it as a very literary and very philosophical medium. For me, fantasy is a way into philosophy. It's a way of grappling with really big questions like, why are we here? And for me, that's always what my fantasy is about. There's a dialogue between reality and fantasy. In fact, I think there's a dialogue between any good literature and reality. And isn't, after all, realism just another genre?
I think I'm coming at this from the other end. For me, the reality, if you will, is always human nature. The fantastic is the spectrum under which human nature expresses itself, or through which human nature expresses itself. And I always start with the reality of people are, in general, people. And I use that in a very large sense, because I have the feeling that most intelligent species are going to have at least a pseudo-rational approach, or the species wouldn't survive. And I say pseudo-rational because we all know what we believe is not always reality. And perhaps the other definition is the gap between what objective reality is and what personal belief is. And we all know some people in whom the gap is quite large. Most of them are politicians, but... In any case, that is, I guess, where I draw the line. For me, the reality is the underlying, call it construct of intelligence, and anything else is variable in a sweep of fantasy. And now I'm going to turn over to the agent, the analytical person, and really put her on the spot.
Okay, this discussion, particularly what Isabel said, reminded me of a comment once made about children, small children. And I remember somebody saying to me, at what age did we stop singing when we got out of bed in the morning? And I don't, for those of you who have children in the room, for those in the room who have children, I don't know whether you've ever noticed that sometimes children just get out of bed and they sing for no apparent reason. And they seem, their reading is so broad, and anything's possible, and the world is wide open, and they're so open to fantasy and any ideas that come from anywhere. And then at some point, as adults, most of us forget that. We forget that singing moment. We become concerned with the dailiness of life. And I think there's that switch that happens, and then it's just a question of how that comes together. And in what levels and what layers as we get older, and how we read and what absorbs us. All of which to say, in terms of readers, most adult readers, the broad general market, they're not singing anymore. They're concerned with the dailiness of life. And they're looking for books and literature that help them with their concerns of daily life. But they've forgot the possibility of the singing. And to immerse in fantasy or science fiction, I think opens that window again, that and I may be mixing my metaphors appallingly here, but it gives us another look again of that childlike wonder and opens our mind to possibility. Now, in terms of the book market, most, you know, the mainstream readership needs to be firmly anchored in reality. That's where they're most comfortable. And in terms of the fantasy elements that come into that, they need to feel that, yes, there is entertainment, but it's also telling them something about the world with which they are concerned. So if you want, you know, the whole broad, you know, we're seeing a lot more crossover now between genre and mainstream. And I think that this is a wonderful thing to see, in the same way we're seeing more lines blurring between reality and fantasy.
That was a wonderful segue into what we're going to talk about next, which is, as an author, how do you represent the fantastic? How do you launch into it? And this time I'm going to start by saying that I launch into it from the very real, from the everyday. I recently discovered that somebody likened me to Anthony Trollope, that I wrote fantasy from the point of view of meat and potatoes, and the fantasy comes in later based on the reality. But that's where I launch it from. But I know from some of these other people's work, they don't launch it necessarily from that point. So the question to the panel is, how do you, or from what perspective, do you introduce your readers to the fantastic elements in your work? And I think we'll start this one with Isabel and go the other way.
With each book, it would be a different approach. Sometimes people ask you, very often people ask you when you've written a lot of books, what your secret is, as if one secret covers all books. Every book is a new journey.
And we're not telling you, so.
Otherwise, you'd be sitting up here. Every book is a new journey. And so for me, the journey, the character, the world that I create is a vessel that rises out of the questions that I'm pursuing. And very often the world that I'm creating is resonating to something that's going on inside the character. So for me, each journey might require a different thing. And I'm not an organized writer in that I don't do... I know there are people who are deeply intimidating. Some of these guys might be those guys. Deeply intimidating, where they have charts and they have lists and they have characters and they have family trees, and I don't do any of that stuff. In fact, I don't even have a map, which was horrifying to Penguin when they first said to me, "Where's the map?" And I said, "What map?" I didn't know I was supposed to have a map, so I had to draw the map from the book, thinking, well, if it took him 3 days to get from, I suppose that must be like, what, that far? It was horrifying, horrifying. So, and you can imagine my maps are really, really accurate. So for me, the world rises very much from the story, and it differs a lot.
Oh. Yeah, I'd agree.
I start from the maps.
I knew it.
I will remain agnostic on the maps question. A lot of that resonates with me. In my book, The Third Sign, I was initially interested in looking at what happens when people feel, in a way, utterly helpless. How do they overcome, if they can, that sense of utter helplessness without giving up? It is something we see repeatedly in the real world. It's something that I wanted to play out a little bit in my fantasy, except I get to do it with, you know, swords and magic and strange creatures and things like that. My problem at that moment, because I do not use charts and graphs, I'm a humanities guy, numbers, please. So my problem was that I had in my mind things that I wanted to accomplish for the story that wouldn't necessarily have fit in with realistic expectations. And were I to go down that route, people would have been, as we always say, that you don't want to be thrown out of the story. So, for instance, I had groups of cavalry moving from one place to another. And my editor, John Helfers, who's a Hugo nominee, emailed me and said, you know, you have this group getting from this place to this place in about a day and a half. How many miles did you anticipate this would take? And I said, I mean, far enough, and he said, the way you have your map listed, it would have taken them more like 2.5 weeks. And he's a military historian. I said, I don't think we can wave sparkly magic over that, can we, John? And he said, no. So I had to make adjustments, you know, based on the realistic shape of the world, in part because all of us need to create worlds that are internally consistent. It is perfectly reasonable to construct worlds in which you can teleport from one place to another, or in which gravity does not function in the same way and is a municipal utility, or, you know, whatever the case may be. But you had better be able to explain that from part A to part B. part B to part C and so on through the book and not forget about it, you know, somewhere in the middle of the book. And sometimes, and I can tell you this is the case, authors will get on this roll, you know, where we'll be writing along and we'll just be in service of the story and all of this dramatically romantic stuff, you know, and then you forget that you had established that this could not have existed. You know, this barrier will kill all who walk through it, but so-and-so walks through it. You can either later on rewrite that and say, but so-and-so had been born near the barrier and was immunized to the, you know.
Both that and the ignoring of reality, I'm afraid, is still all too common in fantasy.
Yeah, that's true. And so you get stuck in a mode of backfilling. So you need to be continually aware, then, of the rules that you've established for your world and maintain those rules. And that will give it this sense of realism, even if you are dealing with mystical creatures and things that could not exist in our world, so long as they're internally consistent in the expectations you've established for your readers from the beginning.
Sally wants to make a comment here.
Yep.
This whole topic and what we've been talking about now, like how do you introduce the fantasy elements, into real world setting and the reality fantasy mix? And I went back to novel by one of my clients, Ailey Martinez. This is one of his books here, and in his book called Monster, there's this opening sentence which I think is wonderfully illustrative of what we're talking about. And so this is the first sentence in the book. And the book is about a guy who is a biocryptologist, i.e. he goes out into the world and he captures the creatures that have slipped through into our everyday suburban world, and he captures them and takes them away to a safe place. So, you know, he's the dog catcher, basically. But he deals with all kinds of fantastic creatures.
A fantastic dog catcher.
Exactly. So here's the opening sentence. The thing was big and white and hairy, and it was eating all the ice cream in the walk-in freezer. So you see, instantly, you've been set up that this is going to be fantastic, just with that the thing was big and white and hairy, and your mind starts to go, oh, I want, you know, what does that look like? How big is that? What is that?
Yeah.
And it says, in the walk-in freezer. And suddenly the whole thing comes crashing into a very domestic, in fact, it's a convenience store, right? So that in one sentence, he's taken us both places straight away like that. And that creates a world instantly in your mind. It tells you where you are, and from that, he can take us anywhere he wants to take us at that point.
Well, let's get technical. I'm only going to do it once.
Not two.
No. Regarding maps, I wanted to mention that in my Virga books, I originally titled Son of Suns Cloud Mapper as I was writing it, which is a terrible title, but because, of course, of the irony of the impossibility of having a map of a world where everything's floating around, right? Then the supreme irony is that I ended up doing maps for the last three books, which, you know, they tell you nothing, but they wanted maps, so I put in maps.
That's bowing to higher reality.
Yeah, exactly. But language for me is the key, and there's one of the seminal articles that I read when I was just starting out talked about the short stories of Zelazny, Delaney, and who was the third? I can't remember. But anyway, and a particular use of language that went on in those stories. In particular, if you pick up Delaney's short story collection, which again I'm blanking on the name right now. Driftglass, that's right. There's a wonderful story called Dog in a Fisherman's Net. And it exemplifies what some writers do, and what I used as a model subsequently, and that is that the prose, the language and the setting and all the elements are mundane and very ordinary through three-quarters or four-fifths of the story. But then there's a point where you don't necessarily introduce a fantastic element, a monster or something like that, but at a liminal moment in the narrative, the language takes off. And Delaney, in particular, is a master of this, because the main character in Dog in a Fisherman's Net gets literally caught in a net and is sinking underwater, and has a momentary, like just a moment where he's under the water. This is set off the coast of Greece in modern day. And he encounters a Greek statue with its arms out that has been under the water for 2,000 years. And it has nets trailing off its arms and things like that. But the way that he describes it, all of a sudden you are transported. And that turns this from a mundane story into a fantasy.
That brings up another question, and that's the question of the use of language in creating the fantastic. And you mentioned Zelazny, who often uses language to great effect, and I'd say that I'm probably at the other end of that spectrum in the sense that I use, for the most part, fairly standard, almost mainstream language to convey a sense of the fantastic. To what degree, I'm going to ask the question, does each of you use language, and is there a point at which you can go too far overboard in the language of the fantastic? I'm going to start with Isabel. You get your turn in a minute, Carl.
But only that I wanted to directly address what you just said about the way you work, but yeah.
You can take a potshot at me later.
No, not in a bad way, in a good way.
For me, it all emanates from character. The language comes from the character, the voice and the mind of the character. The world rises and the reality is established through the character, because if you have a character that's sad or a character that's angry, there isn't a person in this room who hasn't experienced those emotions. Humiliation, fear, passion, terror. So if you have a character that feels that very strongly and passionately, you immediately connect with the reader. So for me, the language of the character is most important. Speaking of language in the way that we're speaking of it now, for me, I'm always drawn to very ornate, rococo, embroidered language. I really love Angela Carter, and it was reading her that made me realize you were allowed to have 7 adjectives attached to a word if they were very good adjectives, and if you put them together very poetically. I come from sort of a storytelling background, so the sound of language is really, really important. There's a poetry in names, in the names of books, in the names of characters, in the way characters speak. There's a resonance that comes, a meter in them, that's really, really important to me. So for me, the language rises out of character and the sound of language.
Greg?
Yeah, I agree with that, and I think that language and tone is something which has come up quite a bit with authors that we've talked to on Speculate and elsewhere. I was on a panel at a conference over the summer called Painting with Words that had on it a few writers, Richard Lee Byers and Brad Bollier, I've mentioned before, and also Pat Rothfuss. And Pat, as some people will know, is a huge fan, he and I both are, of Peter Beagle. So one of the things that we were talking about is the way in which some of the best language of fantasy is able to slip in and out, if you will, of beautiful, poetical languages. Beagle is at his best. You know, Haggard, when he dies, fell like a knife through clouds. And sort of Pat and I both kind of rolled our eyes in that, really? You know, you had to write something that brilliant. Why did you have to write something that brilliant? Because it's brilliantly done, especially if you understand the character of Haggard. The way in which he describes that scene perfectly describes everything you've understood about Haggard to that point. And yet there are other moments in The Last Unicorn. The butterfly who's flittering around, you know, the unicorn, telling her about where her people are gone, and he's quoting from popular songs and advertisements and, you know, things like that. And it's because, as the unicorn says, you know, butterflies are here today and gone tomorrow, and you can't trust anything they say anyway. And yet even the butterfly slips in and out of this sort of beautiful prose. And the effect of going back and forth in this way, from this beautiful lyricism to this sort of, you know, as you suggested, almost mundane kind of language, is it leaves us vaguely unsettled and thus deeply engaged in what is to come. Mm-hmm. That is to say, we are constantly drawn forward by the way in which the language moves, let's say, within the course of the book. And I think most of the time, an ability to shift your tone in that way, and I strive to do this somewhat in my own writing, where I want the tone and the language in some way to reflect the seriousness of the moment, not in a melodramatic kind of way, but to give us this sense that, as you say, the language is taken off in that story by Delaney. I want people to get the sense of it, but also not to believe that, well, I know the way this is going to go, and I don't have to pay any attention now, but that they will continually have to be aware of the ways in which the language and tone shifts. And it's a fine line to walk, because if you do it inartfully, then what you end up doing is irritating your reader, because your reader is constantly, you know, shifting without a clutch, you know, as they're kind of going through the story. But if it's done well, as it's done with someone like Peter Beagle, as I mentioned, then you feel as if you are being almost like eddies in a current, kind of drawn through. That is what I strive to do and will be continuing to strive to do throughout the course of my career, because it's damnably hard. There's a reason Peter Beagle is as good as he is.
Our agent here is getting a little antsy about something there.
Well, I just want to add to this, really, is that don't forget that naming your characters is part of this language issue, hugely.
Right.
And right from the get-go, when a potential reader, you know, when a potential reader goes into a bookstore, I think they've worked out that the front cover has got 8 seconds to attract your eye, 5 seconds to attract your eye and draw you in to pick it up, and then you get something like 8 seconds for the back cover. And on that back cover, dollars to donuts, a character's going to be named. And in the naming of that character, you're giving out a huge amount of information straight away. And if you look, for example, in the George R. R. Martin series, you look at those names, they're kind of close enough to names we know, feel comfortable with, are familiar with. So that's not too frightening for mainstream readers. Fantasy readers are still comfortable. It sets that, you know, so the whole naming thing. Then other times you pick up a book, the name is virtually, of the character is virtually unpronounceable, and then you have a world that is also unpronounceable and has no frame of reference to it. And at that point, you have nothing. As a reader picking up that book, you actually have no information. So I just wanted to add that thought.
I guess I've always been aware of that. Every name I ever use is pronounceable, generally no more than 2 syllables, and vaguely similar to those in current languages. Although occasionally I go to Germanic or French names, which upsets a few people. Carl?
This is good advice right now for me, because I'm in the middle of... I have placeholder names sometimes, and now I'm trying to replace them with having learned my characters, or the appropriate ones. But, I mean, Lee was talking about just using ordinary language. But there's an interesting essay in, again, to invoke Delaney, in his book, The Jewel Hinged Jaw, on the language of science fiction and fantasy, on the level of the sentence. And I'm going to get technical again. And it's
of course,
very,
you're a science fiction writer.
Yeah, but it's very, very simply summarized. In mundane literature, you have a sentence like "The Red Sun Rose," and that sentence is about the subject, about the person who's experiencing the sunset or the sunrise. In science fiction and fantasy, you have constructs such as "the red sun rose while the blue sun set." And that is not about the subject at all. That is that has stepped out of the subject. It's the sentence is about the object. So when you or I are writing science fiction, we are actually employing language right down on the bottom level in a different way than when people are writing westerns or historicals or romances or anything that deals with the world in the that mode.
That leads into actually the next question I was going to ask, which is, when you're writing fantasy, who are you actually writing for? Are you writing for fantasy readers specifically, or are you writing for yourself or some construct in between? Isabel?
I think that I'm writing for myself first. It's an inward journey first that you make as a writer, at least from my point of view. You make that journey to find out what you know and what you think. And I don't think I'm ever writing because I'm telling someone something. I'm usually writing because I'm trying to figure it out for myself. So if I was to have to name an outside reader, it would be me in a reflection, maybe a me that was younger or a me that was older, but it would be someone who read the kind of things that I read. And in fact, when you look at who is reading you, it's not someone who's struck dumb by my wisdom. It's usually somebody who aligns with the things that I'm worried about or concerned about or thinking about. They align with me philosophically, and there's some comfort in sharing those questions and those pursuits and concerns. So I think that's who I'm
looking for. Let Carl have the next shot this time.
Well, I was just thinking about it because I really don't think about that, and that's probably why I'm poor. But if I had to answer it, I would say that writing for me is exactly the same as running in from outside when I was 6 years old and saying, "Mom, Dad, look what I found." That is what I'm doing, and what I'm looking for is someone who will go, "Wow, that's really cool, Carl." Who I can share a sense of excitement with, because pretty well damn near everything about the world that we live in excites and thrills and amazes me, I just want validation. I want other people to tell me that they're just as excited as I am, and they think the world is just as cool as I do.
Don't we all?
I was going to say, this would be a whole panel on author validation.
You could have a whole conference.
Yeah, I was going to say. World Validation Convention 2012. I think this is a complicated question because unquestionably you do write for yourself as an author. You have to because in a way, if you're not true to your own vision of what you're presenting, no one else will buy into this vision either. So you have to be writing in a way for yourself. However, I'm also a teacher, right? And I come from a background in which communication is critical to me. And honestly, the reason that I love writing in the way that I do is because of the process of communicating with others. I would hope that my readers, the ones I try to write for, are the ones who are similarly interested in an exploration of the human condition, even if it's coming from different perspectives, as it undoubtedly will be from my own. And one of the things that I find most interesting about that is when I'm writing for, whether I'm writing for myself or for other people, I need to in some way communicate those concepts to other people. The experience you have, if you've ever had a chance to teach, or I have a four-year-old daughter, who, by the way, doesn't even bother to get out of bed when she sings. She just stays there and sings. So that, when you are trying to communicate the experience of something more complicated or complex, or a world that you've built, or some system of magic that you've developed, or some political circumstance, the ability to be able to condense that and represent it in a form that people understand and are moved by, and that means that you can't reduce it down too far. It means you can't oversimplify it. You have to, in some ways, leave a little bit of the mystery, leave work for the reader to do, and yet give them enough of a bridge to that concept, idea, whatever it is, that they feel like they can get there given time. That is the magic, really, of teaching when it's done properly. And I think it's something which perhaps I've drawn a little bit from in my academic background, bringing it into my creative work and trying to represent it in the same way. The danger for a professor is that you will over-explain, and so you have to be careful about that. But I do think that tracing the line between myself, writing for myself, and the reader that I hope would understand something that I imagined in my head, that private world which I can now share publicly, that is a gift for me to be able to do as an author, and it's something that I think many of us strive to do.
I'm going to reframe this question very slightly for Sally. As an agent, can you distinguish, when manuscripts come to you, those which are blatantly written for an audience and those that come from the heart of an author, and how do you determine that?
That's actually quite a tricky question, because what immediately springs to mind is instinct, but I think we all have it. We know when we're talking to somebody, when they're presenting who they think we want to see, and when they're actually presenting who they are. And one of the most important things when looking at a manuscript is that the manuscript is authentic to the writer. There's an honesty and a truth there and a heart there that does not come through otherwise. there, and I think this goes back to what you were saying, that the your philosophy, you know, you're writing for yourself, but also for a reader who shares your philosophy, or who may be open to your philosophy. And this is the same, and it's because I think one of the most difficult things for new writers getting started is that they're steeped in the authors they love and they want to write that way. And I ultimately I can only, it's sort of a bit like learning to drive, you know, when you get told how to do the hill start and the emergency brake thing and the parallel parking and you kind of learn all these tool sets and you be excited about the fact you see everybody else driving, and then at some point you've just got to do miles to be confident and get down that road without being really self-conscious about it. And a lot of manuscripts do come in as feeling self-conscious or derivative, and yeah, ultimately it's got to be that coming together of who this person is, what they believe, how they think, and then being prepared bravely to share it with us.
I just wanted to make just one little comment connecting these two comments. And for me, I've talked about the inward journey before. Writing is first and foremost always an inward journey, but then you actually have to make the outward journey. And for me, the editing of a book, which is very much part of the creative process, is part of the outward journey. It's to find out, this is what I think from the inward journey, but have I actually communicated that? Does anyone understand? Does that character work? Is this dialogue too long or boring? And at some point, the publisher's editor comes into this process as well. So you do make that outward journey too.
Okay, at this point, I'm going to open it to questions there. We've got about roughly 15 minutes, and we could talk for a long time, but that may not address necessarily some of the questions that those of you in the audience have. Yes, I can see Gone with the Wind with Pansy O'Hara. Another question?
I was wondering, we heard a couple of times from people at the beginning of the conversation about the idea of that moment where a story or a book goes from being something you thought to something you didn't necessarily expect. So it goes from being realistic to fantastic or science fictional, or it starts or it seems like fantasy and then turns into, you discover it's actually science fiction. And one of the examples I always think of is from Gene Wolfe's book of the New Sun, where it seems like a fantasy until you see, the character sees what he doesn't know what it is, but what the reader recognizes as a picture of an astronaut on a tapestry. And I was just wondering, from the perspective of everyone on the panel, whether the need to market things as particular genres and the fact that when you have a book, you already know what it is, whether that's an impediment to sort of the power of that moment.
I'll take a shot at that first and then hand it off to the rest of the panel. I'm fortunate. I started out in science fiction, and I was well enough established that I was able to pretty much write what I wanted to do. This is not necessarily so from what I've observed from a lot of younger writers right now. I'm one of the few, because I'm older generation, who can write anything I want to under my own name, whereas I've noticed an awful lot of younger writers are forced to use different names for different genres because of the marketing pressure. And this ties into your question about how do you change the moment. My personal preference on changing the moment is to start out with the prosaic and just item by item, point by point, you begin to realize that this is not quite what you thought it was, and continue to build it. Now that's what I do, I think, probably best. There are other authors who pull what you might call the China Mieville stunt, which is everything's real normal. Whoops! And it's like you've stepped off the edge of a cliff or a roller coaster.
Of course, in Perdido Street Station, he just plunges you into a world and to really unattractive characters to begin with, and his magnificent feat is he actually...
But that's still the absolute sudden jolt. You open the page and you get the jolt as opposed to halfway through.
Doesn't Perdido Street Station start with strangers?
Well, no, that's what I mean. The first opening pages of Perdido Street are so abrupt that even though you've only opened the pages, you're jolted from your current reality pretty darn quickly, like three sentences.
I remember, again, in science fiction, the beginning of Count Zero by William Gibson, which is... they set a slam hound on Turner's trail in New Delhi, slotted it to his pheromones and the color of his hair. yes, it's a series of indicators, right? It's a series of flags that he's throwing out saying, this is this kind of story, this kind of story, this kind of story. And the first paragraph is like one more sentence. But by the end of that sentence, he has actually literally dumped an entire truck's worth of concepts on you that he's going to use for the rest of the story. It's amazing.
I think this gets back a little bit to the thing we were talking before about the way in which you represent these changes, because what you suggested in the original question is, you know, the people who encounter the Tapestry of the Astronaut are still imagining that in, you know, stereotypically fantastic terms, that is to say, right? We are the ones who understand that as a trope of theoretically science fiction, and oh, this is the world we're dealing with. They don't necessarily construct it that way. This is the argument that often gets used for something like Star Wars, where, you know, you have the tropes of science fiction, and you also have the tropes of the samurai, on which Lucas based this to begin with, and so it is a science fantasy, you know, which sort of is playing in some ways to both worlds. I think some of the interesting ways in which this can be done is there are times when, especially in a short story, when if it's sprung on you at the last moment, that change makes everything before it seem to make sense. There's a story by Louise Erdrich called Love Medicine, in which a character whose name is Lipsha Morrissey, who's Native American, says that he's got the touch, and he goes around and he helps people with their varicose veins, and he, you know, makes their blood pressure drop and all this stuff through this magic touch. And his voice is very slangy and very, I got the touch that no one ever got to see. You know, it's very kind of slang, a young pattern. And his grandfather, who he's very close to, is gradually descending into dementia. Towards the end of the story, there is at one moment a rather radical shift in which the same character, Lipsha Morrissey, uses language like, I went outside and pried the flowers from the earth, waiting for it to give me their sweet return, and all this stuff which has nothing to do with the voice from Lipsha at the beginning. And what you realize here is that in part the spirit of his grandfather has infused him. In fact, not just, you know, metaphorically, but in fact he has been in some ways united with the spirit of his grandfather. That is clearly a moment of fantasy that has entered it, and yet it's done so quietly, almost gently. You feel yourself sort of, almost as the story's over, you think, what just, oh, you know, that's what happened there. And it's not sort of the shock value, it is the rather gentle easing into a change, and it makes everything before in that story make sense because of the change that happened. And I think at least on the story level, that's some of the most amazing stuff to be dealt with.
I'd just like to add to this conversation by saying one of my clients has studied history very deeply, and so he thought he was going to write a historical novel, as this one, The Sad Tale of the Brothers Grosbart. But he knows that back in those days, they did believe there were witches in the woods. So, there are witches in the woods. And this is the reality of people living in medieval times. So, while yes, it's a historical novel, it's written from the perspective of somebody living then, and then fantastic, just kind of creeps on in.
We have a question over here.
Follow up on the point of starting with the graduate from Castle. How do you do that without leaving the reader who was expecting that there's a dragon or a rocket ship on the cover, I'm going to get a rollicking science fiction book, and yet you start with a prosaic of them making toast? How do you keep the reader going and not feel that they're, feel that, yes, there will be fantastic coming, don't you worry, hang on. How do you do that?
One thing is you try not to get that cover that's going to give people that particular problem. Well, sometimes you can't. I mean, my second novel, which was The Hammer of Darkness, was an exact example of what you're talking about. The cover, the original cover on the Avon edition, was a Conan the Barbarian cover. Now, those of you who have read my work know that it is about as many light years from Conan the Barbarian. I can't even make a comparison. And it did not sell very well, needless to say. Interestingly enough, it sold about five times as many copies when it was reissued by Tor with a totally prosaic cover that was not, shall we say, mind-joltingly different from what the subject is. But if you're stuck with the cover, you can only hope that, frankly, your language carries people far enough along. I can't say how I do it, but more than a score of readers have said, I'm one of the few people who can make planing a board sound interesting enough to continue reading. And I think you have to rely on talent to a certain degree to do it. And again, that's just a mastery of craft. But I'll turn that over to a couple of other people because I'm not sure I've answered the question adequately for you.
Well, in terms of craft, one of the things that you do is you have a transitional crisis on page one. You have something going on that's going to engage the reader on another level. It's emotional, it's immediate, it's their dog has just died. Or the dog is missing. On page one, and they're running around trying to find the dog, and you are engaged because you've got a dog or you've had a dog, and you care about these things, right? But the dog is found on page three, and by that time, you are being pulled in the direction of something fantastic, and you just keep on going.
Or you can raise, and that brings up a point, and I guess I should have thought of it, and thank you, Carl. You can also raise an underlying nagging question of the same nature. Why is this person
right?
Yeah, I think you can. I think it actually somewhat depends, in part, also on how established you are as an author. I'm not 100% sure that China Mieville could have written City in the City to begin with as a fantasy writer. I think it could have sold extremely well as a, you know, police procedural that people might then say, wait a minute, what happened? That's possible, but now you expect that you will get fantasy and so you're willing to go along with it. If you are earlier in your career, I'm not sure that you have quite the same latitude, and then what I think needs to happen are these hints that are dropped. And I think the best books of this kind drop these hints that there are strange things afoot. And as Lee said, that's partly a matter of craft, being able to know how many hints to drop and at what time, and over time the fantastic sort of builds up. So that people don't just feel, I'm going to read a novel about toast, like what, you know, but that they feel that there's something else going on below the surface that will continually move them. And by the way, some of the best writers are able to give you enough attention to detail that even within the detail, people begin to feel there's something vaguely off. Mm-hmm. As Carl said, the key is not so much to have fantasy on page one. It is to have engagement on page one, engagement with conflict, engagement with character, engagement with theme. And to the extent that you can do that, people will then follow along. But you have to have a little bit of an internal clock, getting back to the craft, about you only have so long before you have to start having these hints and having these aspects that will then make them realize that they're dealing with the world of the fantastic. But let's remember, fantasy readers are readers, right? And readers want to experience those aspects of conflict. So I would not worry, if I'm writing fantasy, there better be unicorns and dragons, paragraph one. You know, that not necessarily. You know, it also
I've
has to do with how you
write. I've never written a cat, I've never written a dragon, I've never written a unicorn. And that's after 60 books.
I just wanted to say also about the covers, you don't get the cover while you're writing the book. That comes afterwards. So no matter what you've written inside, if you're if you're an early author, you don't have much say over what's going to go on your cover, and you can get some truly putrid covers. But as time goes on, you get a lot more power, and you can just say, I don't want that on my cover. Although I was being translated in some place, and my agent said, you need to have cover control. And Penguin said, well, we don't do that in Australia. And she said, well, you have to have it here. And I thought that was odd. And the guy was very willing. And he said, well, yeah, you can have whatever cover you like. Just go onto the website and have a look at all the covers. So I was really excited. And I went onto the website. And the best cover on his website was a woman with 8 sweating breasts. And I just thought, kill me now. So sometimes that even doesn't help.
We have a question in the back there, a lady in red. From the beginning, probably.
Yeah.
Does anybody else want to take an answer at that?
Yeah, that I think that gets back to what I was talking about before, where the real informs and almost forcibly shapes the fantasy. You know, what makes magic realism? Magic realism is the fact that the fantastic is no longer generates wonder. You know, this we may be amazed at the sight of an angel in the backyard of this peasant's house, and wow, there's an angel here. They look at it as a distraction, first a circus act, and then ultimately they decide to look beyond it when the spider woman moves in next door, and that's much more interesting than the angel that they've had, and they're very relieved when the angel finally leaves. That's an example of when we've lost that sense of wonder, and I think magical realism is a profoundly sad genre, because it is a genre in which not only have we forgotten about the singing, we've forgotten that we ever did it. That example, I think, is what magical realism is trying to show. It is, in a way, a series of cautionary tales. This is what happens when we forget about why fantasy mattered, which I think I'm speaking to the choir here about why fantasy does matter. But that is the problem when mundanity ends up overwhelming the fantastic world.
Last question here. We're close to end of time.
Okay, this is a business question aimed perhaps at Sally, but I'd be interested in other people's take. With the huge success of Game of Thrones, both in book form hitting the New York Times and also on TV, and also the sort of resurgence in, well, not resurgence, but the vast explosion of YA with a fantasy element in it, are we going to see a renaissance, if you like, in the readership that is now going to expand? Or is Game of Thrones an exception?
I think publishers would love to tell you that, this is a whole new renaissance for the fantastic in the finding of a massive new market. I think it comes back to the what we were talking about earlier about how much a mainstream reader can take of the fantasy world and how you coax them into that. And so, I think the thing is that, and I remember a bookseller talking about this, was that as long as they're picking up books and reading them and enjoying the fantastic, that's a huge start. And we'll just have to see what happens. But readers will come into a series like that and then they'll just drop straight out.
The question is whether, in a sense, it's a Star Wars or a Star Trek phenomenon. Most Trekkies, research has shown, read only Trek stuff. People who read Star Wars tended to spread out. And I'm not sure we know yet which direction that's going to go, and it's going to be interesting to see.
I'm sorry, Lee. I was just going to say, I do want to point out very quickly, I'm very optimistic because of the students that I see in my classrooms who, remember, grew up with Harry Potter, are now experiencing Star Trek, are experiencing, you know, if you look at the biggest movies of the last year, how many of them had some fantastic elements, the Avengers and Batman and things like that, that have science fiction feels, fantastic feels, obviously the biggest selling one, Avatar, you know, leave aside opinions about one way or the other, but the idea is that there is a draw to that, and I think my students and increasing enrollments in my classes indicates to me that there are very much a base there that will go forward, I hope.
And I can just add to that for a moment. I think you need to be very aware that while Game of Thrones attracted a mainstream audience, that doesn't mean they're going to go genre. They're going to look for more of the same that's directed to the mainstream
right.
audience. That's the...
Yeah.
It's still optimistic, and that's a good place to end.